Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'm Rod Smith from Awobbical, and welcome to Awobbapod, our podcast. With today's topic, this year's NAIDOC theme, always was, always will be. I'm happy to be in the presence of some real royalty here today, not like the Queen, but royalty in like, hey there, cuz, hey there, you shut me a feed, what? Yeah. And these fellas would. Filling the seats today, I have the honor and privilege of introducing my special guest, as I said. And let me start off with the one and only Andrew Smith, CEO of Warramai Land Council. Mr. Smith, how are you? And how you been travelling with the COVID, and how's your workplace and all that, handling all that?
Days are definitely full. But yeah, no, I'm good. Thanks, brother. Work is fast-paced. I think COVID has only sped everything up. Technology is supposed to make life easier, but it means everybody has contact here now, even when you sleep. So it's just go, go, go. But yeah, no, life's good. Days are full, and the family as well.
Thank you. The ever so flamboyant.
Flamboyant?
Yes, she's very flamboyant. Cheryl Kinchiner, the Hunter Central Coast Project Officer for Aboriginal Affairs. Cheryl, welcome. And how are you? And how's Aboriginal Affairs been handling COVID?
Aboriginal Affairs is on top of it, thank you. And I'm doing well as well. as you know, with Bobby being your brother, we're doing well at home, and COVID's keeping us at home where we're safe, and making sure that we don't mix with too many people. So we're protecting each other and protecting our family.
Very good. The right man, AB Wright.
On your left.
On my left. The New South Wales Aboriginal Land Councillor for Sydney Newcastle Region. Can I say hello, my brother, my cuz, my blood? How are you? And how's COVID, and how's the new role going?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm great. Thanks for having me here today, Rod. New role's great. So I've only been in the job 6 months, and we've been hit with COVID, so it's been a real experience. So it's just getting to know the role, I suppose. Plenty of Zoom meetings. But looking forward to the next 4 years and my term, and looking forward to seeing what I can come up with and help all the mob with in the community.
Any changes you've seen already that you feel like you've been a part of?
Yeah, I suppose just communicating my way with a lot of the mob and a lot of the louts, and trying to engage them together and building towards a better future.
So as I said, a Awobbapod, welcome. This year's theme, NAIDOC, always was, always will be. I'd like to just go around the table just so we can get used to sitting here, and I might start off with you, Cheryl. Just real quickly, always was, always will be, what does it mean to you?
Always was, always will be to me means connection back to my country, means being a proud Aboriginal person in myself personally, with other Aboriginal people, but in this country it's really important. Knowing what political issues we've been through over the last 230-odd years, it's really important for me to make sure that myself, my family, my private family and my extended family really understand that always was, always will be is about yourself and where you fit in this country. And to me, the message surpasses any political movement. It's about us as people on this land.
Mm. Andrew, always was, always will be. Most people would just think land rights. Is that the same for you?
Well, I think they finish it by saying Aboriginal land. I think the slogan always was, always will be, belongs to everyone, all Australians. But it's important that all Australians identify that particular statement is about them recognising and celebrating the original custodians, the ancient culture, the language that exists and that always will exist within this continent. We say Wanyimbu Wanyimbu, which is always and always. That's in the Gadang language here locally. And I think we need to get away from all of the red tape and bureaucratic nonsense and legislation that comes with that sort of stuff, and just start celebrating collectively. And it's an opportunity to develop a relationship to help wider Australians understand that ongoing and unbroken connection that we as Aboriginal people have with this beautiful country. I mean, if you think about it, one of the things that they need, non-Aboriginal people connect more with our our artwork and our artifacts and our basket weaving.
Yeah.
But they refuse to have a relationship with the people because they think it's too contentious. But that's all the spin doctoring nonsense that they sell on the media about us.
Yeah.
When we're more prone to friendship and relationship. Relationship creates identity, which creates connection, which lessens the divide in conflict, which eliminates racism. And that's what always was, always will be for me is about.
AB right. Always was, always will be.
Obviously Aboriginal land. I suppose acknowledging and respect. I think it comes back to respect. And we, as Aboriginal people, we've got a responsibility that we've always had for thousands of years. These ancient laws have been passed on to us, and that's to look after family, community and connection. But land is obviously a big part of that, and it's who we are as Aboriginal people. And I think there's a there's an undertone of spirituality that non-Aboriginal people don't understand because they don't have a connection to this country. Mm. And I think if we sat down and like Andrew was saying, they connected with the people and had a conversation with about that instead of us and them mentality, I think that Australia would be in a whole better place as far as respecting each other and people wouldn't feel so disconnected with country and people and community.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Do you want to respond to any of those?
Yeah, look, I'd like to add to something there too. Yeah. One of the things that, I suppose I'm a lot older than you guys, but one of the things that I've noticed through my life is that when I was growing up, respect for culture was a given. Respect for elders was a given. Connection to land was a given. We all kind of knew where we belonged to. That's
it
right. We
lifestyle.
Always knew.
Yeah. It was just life.
Yeah. And since moving down here to Newcastle, what I've found out is a lot of even our own people have disconnected from country, have disconnected from family, and have disconnected from culture.
Say, I suppose with all of us being having our family, the early part of that pioneer of building Newcastle, would you say it's because maybe they're focused was channeled into creating like the co-ops and you know better housing and that for us, would you say that? Or
I think prior to all of the legislative government constructs that were built to hopefully support our community, prior to all of that, when you think about our old people that you know took up the fight on the, you know, a smell of an oily rag and a Devon and chip sandwich to go out and make sure that we had a voice.
Yeah.
Mm.
It was just about one. We were just one. All the families are connected. So as you guys know, it wasn't just our family. There are many families here in Newcastle that bonded together. And it wasn't, we weren't pigeonholing each other. We weren't saying, well, you belong here and you belong there. Because what the legislation did was it created these government constructs which fed it money. And then that, I wouldn't say the inability, but the at that current time, it created smaller empires and people started to disassociate and disassemble and started to disconnect from each other around the government legislation construct of what it meant to look after people. And families sort of looked after families. And I just think somewhere we lost sight of some of that.
Yeah.
And it became really difficult. And our culture, which is just our lifestyle, which is just the well-known and the thing that didn't have to be taught about respect, it kind of just got somehow pushed to the side and our culture became commodified. So the commodification of our culture started to, traditionally, I always say this, traditionally we would hunt the kangaroo and we would share it. Now the kangaroo exists on a dollar coin and we're all hunting the gold coin kangaroo and they don't know how to share it anymore.
Yeah.
And that's really, really frustrating.
That's pretty good.
And our culture, the commodification of our culture has been, we're now competitors. Because there are people that want to learn about culture, and if you're going to teach it, they're not going to listen to me. Mm. So I'm going to attack you. And we've got to stop. Lateral violence is our greatest enemy, and we need to stop fighting with each other.
Mm. True, true.
And again, I think that going back to always was, always will be, it's not good enough just to be living in country.
Mm.
What you need to do is you need to go out and understand what the river systems are doing, what the landscape's telling you. I mean, that's the essence of who we are. And if you don't understand that, then I think just living in country is not good enough.
Mm.
Anybody can live in country, any country.
Yeah.
But understanding that connection, who we are, how those rivers run, where they run to, where they connect to our other nation groups, our brothers and sisters from other countries, that's who we are as a people. That's always was, always will be to me.
Yeah.
Colonisation, I think it's played a huge part in the fact that it's we're all chasing the dollar, like you were saying, Andrew, now. It's at a point where government have set structures and parameters and they continue to divide Aboriginal community by setting up similar organisations. And we're actually talking through some issues at the moment at state in regards to the cultural heritage across New South Wales. Obviously, what's happened over in Western Australia with the Juukan Cave, and now we're focused on state land council is us, New South Wales here, and specifically I'm focused on my region and what we can actually do to save our sites. And I think that people don't realise the connection that we have to country, because it's the same as writing down on a piece of paper. You write something down, you can actually attract that to yourself when you sit there and you focus on it. And I think it's similar with a lot of our sites as well. We have these special places where we go to, and we can attract this energy and these different things we can think about, and we don't realise that connection to country and what they actually mean. But I think colonisation is really it's in conflict with our traditional values, in that it's really individual, whereas we look at things as a group, as a collective, and we think of one mob, they'd all like that, whereas the conflict between what I like and what my mob like, it's like, oh well, there's too many of them, I can't invite them around, they eat me out and they do this and they do that and we can't afford that this week. But it's that conflict of living in today's society and wanting those modern cons, and for you and your children wanting better. But it's sort of like we have that, we disconnect them from family and community, and we're finding our kids are being disconnected from their family and that strength, and that's when these mental health issues and the drugs and alcohol seem to come into play. And it's really a tool that's being used through colonisation to actually disconnect us from our power and our strength, which is family and community.
Yeah, family and community.
Talking about colonisation, I'm going to chuck this at you. Terra nullius. It's a Latin expression meaning nobody's land. Also, land that is legally deemed to be unoccupied or uninhabited. Andrew Smith, when I say terra nullius to you, how do you feel?
It pisses me off.
Don't hold back, Andrew, please.
Well, it's the great white lie, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they say, you know, there's only little white lies. It's the greatest of all. The First Fleet, what people need to understand, is the largest deliberate and strategic migration of humans ever in the history of the world. And they came here with a purpose.
Yeah.
They came here based on the scribblings of Captain Cook, who first penned it as Terra Nullius. And when Philip drove through the Sydney Heads and he saw the Gadigal and the Gammeraygal people standing on the cliff faces looking down, he literally asked himself, who are these people? Why haven't they been written down and recognised? I mean, they had three choices. They could have declared an act of war, and as prisoners of war, Aboriginal people would have had certain rights and freedoms and treated as humans. They would have had humanity. And we could have taken up citizenship under the crown, and we would have then been able to occupy and live in harmony in the same space. They could have recognised our sovereign rights and given us that, and by a legal contract have purchased land. But they obviously realised that that wasn't going to happen. Or they could completely ignore that we are here and cull us like they culled the land to farm it under their Western ways, and that's what they chose. It says that when the colony in Sydney was so full with the free settlers and the soldiers and the government and the emancipated convicts, that new arrivals took groups of men and guns to use them to go out and occupy what they called the free lands. There was no free land.
We were
here. The bloody Dutch were here in the 1600s. 26 different Dutch explorers bloody called it New Hollandia, New Holland. Yeah. I mean, just because Cook, shouldn't call him different names, decided to go on along the East Coast, didn't make it any different. The bloody Mackesons from Indonesia were trading through the 1700s for sea cucumbers with the traditional people. The Dutch were here. The Spanish were here. There are glass-tipped spears in our museums where our traditional people used the glass that came from the Spanish ships to create, rather than using stone tool artifacts. The fact that they decided to ignore that and identify us as people is just completely bloody ignorant, and it's a lie, and it frustrates.
I think it was you that I was talking to a long time ago, where about the Dutch and that being here 200 years before.
Yeah.
And it's like the and Dutch trade, and the yeah, and the Spanish, yep. And it's like, well, or it might have been, I don't know, it was one of yours where it's like, are you going to tell me that the English didn't know Australia was here?
Mm.
Terra Nullius, Cheryl? Mm.
They knew it was here. They knew it. All he did was navigate the East Coast and try and pan it and call names and stick a flag in the ground and say, I claim it on behalf of the Crown. He didn't circumnavigate the whole of Australia. They didn't do that until it was Flinders. Was it Flinders? One of those others. And he took an Aboriginal man from the Gadigal mob with him that went around.
Benelong, I think.
Benelong, might have been Benelong. I know that Tamaway was a freedom fighter because of what they did to him in Parramatta. And so there's so many different stories. Look, Terra Nullius is just a complete blatant bloody lie. And the fact is, it wasn't even called Australia until early 1900s, when the six colonies, or the six...
During Federation.
Yeah, in the Federation, when they had a referendum, and they decided to pen Australia and join the colonies and come under one Commonwealth. And so people want to talk about celebrating Australia Day, do it on that day. Don't do it on the day that they arrived and treated our people like animals.
Invisible.
Invisible.
Yeah.
I think it was calculated, and I think that the calculated moves were...
Very calculated.
Were done by people that are... to be honest with you, I think there's some serious mental health issues going on in the non-Aboriginal community. They keep focusing on other people having serious mental health issues.
Yeah.
But they're in real denial, and they need to actually confront what the hell the lies. These continued people that they put up as heroes, when their actions speak louder than their words. And there's some pretty disgusting stuff that a lot of those people have done, and they're lauded in the streets, and they put up as monuments in the streets, and I think that that's where a lot of non-Aboriginal people are embarrassed, because they know they're walking around and they're feeling this lie, and everyone else knows it's a lie. But until Australia confronts all of these issues with these so-called great explorers, Australia is going to continue to feel yucky. Everyone's going to continue to feel divided. Yeah. They don't want to engage with people, because if you know you've done wrong by someone, and you know your people are still doing wrong by someone, you don't want to engage with them.
And because you're embarrassed. You make an excellent point.
Yeah, that's true.
We were just talking about, Cheryl and I were just talking about how so many times when you see all of the, I mean, the reason why we even have Closing the Gap initiatives is because all of these things are real.
Mm.
But when you think about the first colony arriving in 1788, they didn't move. Here's an interesting fact: they didn't move up north until quite later. And in fact, the Australian Agricultural Company had all of the land locked up in Port Stephens. And it wasn't until around the mid to late 1800s, that they dropped the leases and it became available for purchase by the free settlers and the emancipated convicts. So my elders today in Warramai Country are the grandchildren of first contact, and people wonder, why are you so angry? What's wrong with you people? And I get frustrated that I go,
yeah, I get you.
Why don't you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not angry at non-Aboriginal people. What I'm frustrated about is that the policies that government wrote for on our behalf oppressed us and benefited non-Aboriginal people. So we talk about white privilege. They call it black entitlement now because of all the handouts. But the handouts is another government control system. They're throwing chips to seagulls, and we're fighting over it and killing each other for it. And we've got to stop. We need to put all that aside. Always Was, Always Will Be is about recognising that all of that bureaucratic nonsense, legislation, government pigeonholing each other stuff, let's put it aside and remember that we are connected, all of us as Aboriginal people, and all Australians have a responsibility for the relationship and the conversation to start.
So and that won't happen until we re-look at the Constitution, to be honest. Yeah. But also, recently, looking at the Uluru Statement. I mean, that's a document.
The statement of the heart,
yeah. Yeah, that's a document from us, to the broader Australian people about what we want for our own people. So it's not about handouts. Yeah, it's not about handouts.
Yeah.
It's about us being proper citizens of this country. Yeah. We were given citizenship. Yeah. But what does it really mean to be an Aboriginal person that has that right?
What do we need citizenship? Well, yeah, and what do we have to go on and ask someone to tell us?
Absolutely. Look,
it's like we're being accepted, wanting to be accepted by a group of people who hates us. Because have a look at the policies and the oppression that continues to happen.
Well, a government system that hates us. Not necessarily the people. The people of Australia.
The intervention was a perfect one.
The system that we're all caught in. Mm. And while the government can create this sense of white privilege and black entitlement, the government are causing us to fight. The people on the ground want to have a relationship.
Yeah.
When do we stop fighting and just start talking?
The Westminster system has been weaponized against Aboriginal people. Mm. So from everything, from intervention, all of these different policies are there. These weapons are all there for politicians to use against Aboriginal people when they feel like we're starting to get a little bit of footing, or we're starting to get a little bit of ground and a little bit of economic power, and then they go woofter. Yeah. They cut the legs straight from under us. It's weaponized. So I actually think to myself, what sort of people are actually doing that? We're going back to this mental health issues again, I think. There's a hatred there, and there's an underlying... dislike for people and an institutionalized disengagement from their feelings of humanity. Yeah. Because when you're doing that to a person, or when you do something wrong by someone, you go, you know what, I can't.
It's also the concept, their concept of what they're looking at for us and from us. And the fact that they see this country as something that they can take.
So they take the
resources, they talk about ownership. Mm. We don't talk about ownership.
Ownership
we
is not
talk
part
about
of it.
Belonging
what do you think the
to,
government?
Not owning of.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you don't live in a country for thousands of years and don't know there's gold and silver and diamonds and all that. But we never put the same value on that as family.
We're trying to mesh two cultures. The Western concept of ownership and the Aboriginal cultural ancestral connection about just being. Yeah. And trying to mesh them, there's conflict there straight away.
Yeah.
Mm. Ownership is, like Cheryl said, they live on the land. They see it as an unfinished commodity. Mm. For us, land is mother. It's just connection. It's a part of our being. It's part of who we are.
Yeah.
And the mental health issues, Abe's right, they're coming because a lot of our people just aren't centered in that cultural space anymore. And they're in a grey space. They're caught between the yearning for what is their ancestral right and connection and belonging and being, and their mismatch, misfit, being ostracised from a government system that's... I mean, you've only got to look at NAIDOC. NAIDOC always was, always will be. But when we go to NAIDOC celebrations, it's not a celebration of the survival of our culture. It's a celebration of service providers.
That's right.
Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. Incarceration, domestic violence, youth, you know, drug and alcohol.
Yeah.
They're all the...
Centrelink,
all of that, Centrelink, unemployment.
Mm.
At what point do we go, we love what you're doing because there's a need, but this is a celebration of our culture and our survival as people.
Mm.
When do we get rid of all of that and just come together as one?
Close the gap is an industry now
that
people can make money off it.
Yeah.
Everything. The Aboriginal industry, and that's what it is.
Yeah.
People are getting paid off Aboriginal people suffering.
Yeah. That's right.
Genetic indicators in Aboriginal people, this has been shared to me with genealogists and all these biologists, people that do that stuff. There are two cultures in the world. I won't say race because we're all human race, but there are two cultures in the world that have a genetic indicator that causes heightened levels of mental health, suicide, depression and stress. And they are Aboriginal people of Australia, and even the Aboriginal people of the Native Americans, and the Jews, because of the Holocaust. Yet the world will accept the Holocaust happened. When do they accept that the massacres in Australia happened? When do they say, okay, enough's enough, we recognise it, let's go on a journey together.
There are movies in high school.
They're too scared because they think it's going to open up this big can of worms of compensation.
Yeah.
That's money. I'm not interested in money. I'm interested in relationships.
Yeah.
Conversations.
Let me just, Derek, just in a different way, sovereignty. Like, we've had a lot of great times in this country, in the Aboriginal history, if I say, where we have had very important moments. The song From Little Things, Big Things Grow, written by Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody, about the... Cheryl, you know a lot about that. What was it again? The Wave Hill Walk-Off. Other things that have happened, the beginning of the New South Wales Land Council.
Okay, look, there's been a lot of political movements in this country.
A lot.
And look, we as Aboriginal people, when we first fought in this country to be recognised, it was not about land rights.
That's right.
It was actually about being treated as a human being in our own country.
Yeah.
It was about being paid the same wage as everybody else was being paid for the exactly the same amount of work. So if you look at our political movements, it's about being recognised as humans in our own country. Those movements changed, and they changed for good reasons. And when we look at back in 63, when we had Vincent Lingari actually talk to our Prime Minister about land rights. The first time we spoke about land rights, when they took down the Bark petition. Again, we were promised. We were promised then about land. We were actually promised a treaty back then. The conversation started around sovereignty. Sovereignty is really important to us. It gives us access to all of those resources that in this time, in this moment, we're able to build our capacity as Aboriginal people in this country the way we want to do it. We can't go back to living off the land like we used to. It's all locked. You would know that, Abe. Working in land councils, you guys both know that. It's not, we can't go back and just get what we want from our traditional lands.
A lot of our resources are gone.
Our resources still remain, but we've been locked out of that. We will never get it unless we have sovereignty. We'll never get it unless we have a treaty. Land rights has not given that to us. Native title has not given that to us. If we have a treaty or we actually have sovereign rights to this in this country, that's the only time we get access to those resources.
The Mabo decision really started to unravel the argument of terra nullius. But it didn't remove the sovereignty of the Commonwealth government and allowed them to say that there is a one government common law in this country. So we've still got to ask them for permission for our native title rights, which still comes under their construct, which really doesn't give you much more rights than what you've got through normal processes anyway. Everyone in, most Aboriginal people are fighting for native title rights. I think they should go away and read it very carefully and realise that it's still a very locked, controlled system.
The Mabo decision was just more about that he was identified as traditional owners.
Recognition.
It?
Yeah.
Recognition.
Where did he have to prove himself?
I know.
Who does he need to prove himself to? People who know nothing about his land.
The oppressors.
Look, the land rights movement in New South Wales has been probably the really prominent thing for us, and nobody can say that that hasn't been positive in this country. But it's also got had a negative effect on us.
It's still an oppressive compliance system. Let's not the Land Rights Act system is us playing their game to our advantage, and we've got to remember that it's the strongest piece of legislation that we have to get land returned to our communities. But it's what we do with the land and working with our communities and our local people and our local registered Aboriginal owners and making sure that we identify best use. It's not just about subdividing everything and building houses and doing all of that. It's about working with the community to identify what do we need? What do we want to achieve? You know, so I'm a supporter of the Land Rights Act. Is there a better system? Possibly, but right now it's the strongest piece of legislation that we have in this whole continent.
But I would also challenge the Land Rights Network too to have a look at what happened back in 1977 with the original people that actually started to discuss land rights in this country, especially in this state. Looking at the rights, you know, building back in culture and heritage back into the land rights system, building back into those resources in the land rights system. We haven't looked at that type of stuff. We haven't challenged ourselves enough in those particular areas. I agree with you. I think the land rights system is the strongest and the most powerful system in New South Wales, and we have to get behind it and we have to back it. But like I said, there's still things that we need to do.
But the Land Rights Act can't be about individuals building personal empires. It's got to be, we've got to get back to the basics, connection and people and community. That's really important. The scariest thing for me, now I keep getting touted as one of the most successful land councils in New South Wales, and certainly I would have to agree with that in some aspect, but we've got a very strong, powerful group of elders and community that get behind me. It's not the Andrew Smith show. This is a community driven process. My fear is that if we don't redirect those resources and start creating some autonomy of business outside of the system, a new minister comes in and, like Abe said, cuts us off at the legs and it all goes away. So how do I start empowering our community to start thinking bigger and going, let's create earth-moving companies and transport companies and let's open our... In the Chinese community, They own so many of their own autonomous businesses that the dollar stays within their own community for something like 48 days before they need an outsider to come in and provide a service that they don't have.
Yeah.
We don't have that economy within our own people, and we need to start building it. We need to keep our wealth within ourselves.
See, there's so many bolts and padlocks and all that on our lands. James Christian, the CEO of State Land Council, just come out at the moment and spoke about the huge backlog of Aboriginal land claims that government are just looking at, and they're just they're ignoring, and they've been ignoring them since the 80s.
They're sitting on
They're sitting there, and you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars worth of land economically that could be out into the community, and those dollars could be supporting Aboriginal businesses and what you're saying, Andrew, building that economy. But there's still a racial divide, and there's still stereotypes there that that people can't get past, local government, state and federal. And so we've got these barriers that just to get our land claims through, and we're looked at as a successful land councils in my region, but
so many others that are asset rich and cash poor because the restrictions on them being able to do something are so tight that they can't move. Yet if the Darricons and the Landcoms and all of the big development companies own those lands, not that we want to be doing what they're doing, but we are, as land councils, we are the most regulated, restricted and compliant business of any company in the world.
Yes.
Not just in New South Wales, in the world. Mm. So what they've done is they've created a system for empowerment, protect, promote and foster the best interest of our community, which is great, and we're doing good things and trying to provide employment the best that we can. But the reality is they've torn down the barbed wire fences around the missions and reserves, and they've given us legislation. So we are still controlled. So, and that's
like a big stick hanging.
That's
over
the
us.
One thing that the community that I work with recognises. How do we continue to empower ourselves to get outside of the system and just do what we've had the right to do since time immemorial? That's been forcibly taken from us, and we're still fighting for it today. And I say to all Australians, all wider Australians and Aboriginal, it's not about wanting more. We just deserve the same. And if anything, we probably do deserve more, but we're not even arguing for that. Yep. We're standing here just saying, hey, let's remember that this is the oldest living culture in the world, and always was, always will be, means that it's never going away.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
A couple of things I just want to ask real quickly, and Cheryl, I'll ask you because not trying to make any fun, but like when we're talking about the 67 referendum and Laura and Fauna, which we were discussing earlier.
Flora and Fauna.
Flora and Fauna.
I don't know Laura.
I don't know Lorna either.
So I was born in 71, and I think like only 4 years before.
Yeah.
Do you remember that time, and what did it feel like? Because that's when they recognised us as Australian citizens, wasn't it?
Yeah. Look, I was pretty young myself back then. Because you know I'm only 21.
do you remember much of it? And like,
look, I do. It's not that you know, we grew up in a family in Armidale, which is we were one of the very few families that actually owned their own home, right in the middle of town, through the hard work of our uncles and family.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we had a lot of Aboriginal people coming and going from our home. Like we do, you look after the mob. So in saying that, you were always part of a bigger community, but you were separated. So you knew that, you lived with that. At times it was subtle, at times it was really, really bad. And it's similar to what we were doing, to what's happening today, but when you're the only black family in a country town that actually has ownership over their home, and you're living under a regime where you're not even considered an Australian citizen, it was really difficult for my parents, for my grandparents, for my uncles and aunties who worked there. You know, they worked really hard. Yeah. They worked on properties, because back then you couldn't work in the town. So you're either cleaners, you work in laundry, or you're stockmen. So again, you work in the lowest paid jobs, doing the hardest work, trying to build a future for yourself and your family, but you still weren't allowed to go to the pub. You still weren't allowed to go to the picture theatre. You still weren't allowed to go to the pool.
Yep.
Yeah.
So you knew those things. You consciously knew those things as a kid. You were living those things as a kid, thinking that was the norm.
Yeah.
And not understanding that you, that everybody else was allowed, and you didn't understand why you weren't allowed, you know? Yeah.
Thinking about all those things, that's why the magic of Smith's General Contracting is such a powerful story.
Absolutely.
Because it was done in that time.
Yeah.
People don't realise that. They took $5 and turned it into a multi-million dollar company and didn't just employ Smiths, employed Aboriginal men from all over New South Wales. Yeah. I had a gentleman visit the Wyoming Land Council only just last week from Moree. He would have been in his late 60s, 70s. And when I told him who I was, it was almost like tears. Oh, I knew your father and Bill and Bob. Mm. I came down here and I worked with them. I lived out at Massey Fern at the time. And he shared stories that I didn't know. And he remembered what it was like.
Mm.
I mean, and you know, Abe's dad, he was out there and amongst them all, swinging the sledgehammers, getting those railway tracks laid and building Port Waratah Coal Depot.
Mm-hmm.
Aboriginal men that were even accused by the state government of formulating a terrorism cell, because why are so many Aboriginal people coming to Newcastle to live? There's something else going on. Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, there was a suggestion that there's a terrorism cell of Aboriginal people. There's rise up. Why are all those people coming to Newcastle? Because there was work.
Yeah.
That's it. It's the only reason.
Yeah. Mm.
That's crazy. And let me tell you something about this, the referendum. There's elders in Warramai country who say it's probably one of the worst things that ever happened, because the day that it happened, the government walked in. So prior to it happening, the Aboriginal men and women were working hard. They were the founders of the oyster industry, which was touted as the biggest in the world, the timber cutting industries and all of that. But the government's walked in and said, hey, you don't have to work no more. We can give you unemployment benefits.
Mm.
And literally started to derail our extremely high work ethic and started to inbred a new culture of not working, which was really frustrating.
Yeah.
But also, the referendum vote was based on seats, right? So let's just say, there are more seats in the Sydney Basin in a very small demographic, a collection, right, that didn't have any contact with Aboriginal people. But there were more seats down there.
The
seats that existed in the Kempseys and the Morees and the Armidales and that, they all got the no vote. They all voted no. We were just lucky that there were more seats that voted yes that didn't have contact that went, oh, well, I don't have a problem with them. I don't see any on the streets when I'm going shopping. So sure, I'll vote yes. So there were just happened to be more yes votes than no. But if they did it based on demographic of population of Aboriginal people, it would have been beaten and we wouldn't have had any rights. So let's look at the truth. Australia,
well, I suppose you look at the freedom
Australia
right.
Has too many prejudices.
What year was that? Charlie Perkins with the freedom right.
I think
I suppose
was
when you went out those country towns, it was all no.
Yeah, true.
Look, we're going to finish up. Just a couple of things. Education. Maybe I'll start with you. Is that the way to change things?
Oh, definitely. Like, I think education has to be run by Aboriginal people with Aboriginal schools. It's 100%. The only way to learn from someone is actually from people who have actually gone through it and have lived it every single day. It's a lived experience. So if you want to know anything about Aboriginal people, even same as Aboriginal people that have been disconnected from community and now are trying to reconnect, that's a hard one, that one. That's a big debate in itself, but education is the only way forward and run by Aboriginal community, real Aboriginal community. So just because you have an Aboriginal ancestor back doesn't make you Aboriginal as far as I'm concerned. And we're seeing a lot of those effects at the moment through New South Wales with a lot of people coming in with different principles, different values and different mind constructs that are in conflict with Aboriginal community itself. But definitely education. It's got to be driven by Aboriginal people, controlled and run by Aboriginal people itself. But just what you were saying earlier to Andrew in regards to
referendum or
no, before that, sorry,
Land Rights Act, that being powerful legislation.
Disconnection.
Yeah.
So when Aboriginal families did get money and family did actually work their way out of those holes, a lot of family actually disconnected from family and moved off, and that's a big it's a big one that we struggle with today, because we've got a lot of Aboriginal family that are really disconnected from us and really struggle to engage with us in different family activities, and that's a real issue that we're up against now. I think that's one of the new big challenges that we have with reconnecting community and family
I want to ask you the same thing.
Could I just say, look, with education to me is really important. I know for a fact that in my family I was the first Aboriginal person to go to university. you know, living in Armidale, and I was living at the on the mission at the time, the first Aboriginal person from the mission to ever go to the university as a student. Not as a cleaner, not in the garden, not in the laundry.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a big thing. I didn't understand it at the time, you know, but it was a big thing for our community and it was a big thing for our family.
Mm-hmm.
And but I think the gift that I had was that I had elders in my community that believed in a balanced education.
Mm-hmm.
So never forget where you come from.
Yeah.
Never forget who you are. Your culture is your strongest point that keeps you centered. It keeps your foundation. That has to be just as strong as you going and learning the white education.
Mm.
We have to learn white education. We have to be able to compete on the same level. But don't forget where you come from and why you're doing this. Because we're doing this as Aboriginal people to better ourselves and to actually compete, you know, not with each other, but to compete in this world on an equal footing. So I was lucky enough to have the benefit of both those types of education.
Yeah.
So when I think about education, I don't think about white fellas, I think about our education, that's our good culture.
Because the more, I suppose, we empower ourselves, the more we can do. Can I ask you with education?
Can I talk about education real quick?
Yeah.
On you go.
Yep. No, with education, and on a government level, how do you change that?
I think, first of all, that what they need to understand is it's about finding the balance and realising that we are the first teachers. And it's about, Abe's right, we need to be taking our kids back out on land and on country and teaching them to give them a sense of well-being and connection, understanding in here and in here. Because they're going into these schools and they're completely mixed up and mucked up by the system. And so, and it's not their fault because there's a intergenerational trauma that's occurring. So the teachers can just look at that child, but they don't appreciate what's happening at home and what's happening before that when they were children. And it's just getting handed down and handed down and handed down. We need to get back to the basics. My cousin Cheryl's son, Stephen, posted something really powerful today, which I just thought was fantastic. We are the original teachers. Geography was taught on the land. Marine biology was taught in our rivers, lakes, and oceans. Science and ecology was taught with our resources, and our astronomy was taught at night.
Mm.
And they weren't sitting down in a classroom written out tests, it was demonstrated and became a way of life.
Mm.
That's who we are. We are the original and the first teachers of the land. And we need to get back to the basics and start creating, not so that I send a kid out for a job interview and that says, oh, I can play a didgeridoo and shake a leg and make a basket. That's not going to get him a job. But it's so that I can make them healthier inside through their understanding. So that when they go back into the school environment, they can sit there empowered by that knowledge and not feel threatened by an environment that is a Western construct.
Yeah.
That's what's important.
That's good. I laugh at it because I see myself a bit in that. I did get a lot of jobs through didgeridoo and shaking Look, I just want to finish off with a bit of local business. As you know, with NAIDOC, usually it's every July, and we get to walk up the Hunter Street, and as a march, as in, not as in protest, but as we say, NAIDOC's a celebration.
Absolutely.
So since the trams have come in, and which are owned by the New South Wales State Transport, no marches or nothing stops the trams, only the V8 supercars, which also comes under the state transport.
Wow.
So what do we do? I mean, last year's NAIDOC, Ray Kelly Sr. got up, was quite vocal and frustrated, saying, look, we're getting... And if he saw where we did have the march, he said, you know, next minute we'll be marching over back of Waratah somewhere, you know. That's how far they're going to push us back. Mm. Aby, what do we do? As someone, your blood roots, and I mean, your commitment here to Newcastle, what do we do?
It seems to me that state government and the white man respects the dollar. So it's all about economic power. So the supercars bringing money to the town, it supersedes us as a community and our struggle and our history to this country, 60,000 years. So someone come up with an idea of a supercar race challenge and they've got more dollars than what the Aboriginal community's got. So it seems to the white man worships that dollar. So I can only see the way forward for us is economic power. Group economics is the way forward for us, same way as different groups all around the world. I think it's all about teams at the moment, to be honest with you. I think it's always been about teams. It's been countries, and now you have a look at the big players. You're talking about the Americas, the Chinas and all that. And I think that's all about economic power and strength and money and flexing on each other. And the more money we get, the Aboriginal community, the more respect we're going to get. And some of these politicians...
Just that's all they listen to, eh?
Exactly, yeah. So,
that's a good point.
Yeah, I think that's the way forward for us. But obviously education, if we can get to different politicians. But at the end of the day, people are going to be worried about number one. And whether, I don't know, their motivation behind stopping us from marching down the street, whether they feel threatened, whether they feel guilty in pushing us over the back so they don't have to see us and we don't have to be in the main street. But the issue is we're never going away and our issues and
always we're going to continue. Always
yeah, we're going to continue to talk and we're going to take back control of our country through economic power because they only... Australia's up for sale. And, it is what it is.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Abe, but I think also that the message we should be given, spreading to our own mob, is don't become complacent.
Yeah,
that's
we
right.
have been fighting this fight from the day these fellas invaded our country.
Yeah.
Our kids don't know enough of this struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We need to let the wider Australia know that we're not going to be sitting back and just taking this, that we don't have to get up and we don't have to take arms. We've got a voice and our voice is powerful and this land is our connected, it's our mother and we're not giving that up for anybody. So don't become complacent, speak up and fight for what is really ours.
Think about our kids, they're growing up in an environment where all they know is social services and handouts.
Yeah.
It's all there. What are we arguing for? What are we bid for? They're handing it out. No, that's keep the mob happy or keep the mob quiet money.
Yeah.
That's all that is.
Look, I'd like to thank you all very much, AB, Cheryl and Andrew. This topic has been a lesson for me and I would just like to say, just any last words before we wrap up? Andrew, I'll just finish with...
I just want to say hello to all the beautiful mob out there, community, family, loved ones, family and friends. And I'm sorry if you don't see me much. Days are full and I hope to catch up with you all soon. Love yous.
I just want to say stay safe.
Stay safe.
Look after each other and bring up every now and then and just, keep contact with everyone.
Maybe you're right.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, Rob, for having me today. It was a privilege to be on a panel with two such smart people and people that I look up to and love in my community and role models like yourself too, Rod.
Thank you.
And, keep doing what you're doing, man, and this great stuff. And
yes.
And this stuff here will be for generations to come. And I look forward to actually sitting back as an old man.
What we were saying at this time.
I can honestly say, time does cut it short, but we could easily go for another hour.
Yeah.
But Andy's looking at me over there, giving me the eyebrows, so yes. So once again, thank you for joining us on this year's theme, which I'm sure a lot of people, when they listen to this, and not just that you're going to open their eyes. Honestly, you're going to open their eyes, and hopefully we can open some of their hearts and their thoughts too.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.